The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
President Trump's lawyers wrap up their defense at the impeachment trial today. Their argument to the senators listening, this trial is all about politics.
You are being asked to remove a duly elected president of the United States, and you're being asked to do it in an election year.
As for President Trump, he was busy today unveiling his new Middle East peace plan. He called it a historic opportunity for the Palestinians.
After 70 years of little progress, this could be the last opportunity they will ever have.
And in the Chinese city of Wuhan, the coronavirus emergency has one college student stuck in place.
They are telling us that we should not go outside our campus, but definitely I can go out of my dormitory.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. After years of preparations, leaks, and rumors, the Trump administration's long-awaited Middle East peace plan has finally been unveiled. In a White House ceremony with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, President Trump laid out the details of what he's billing as the deal of the century.
My vision presents a win-win opportunity for both sides.
The 80-page plan, spearheaded for the past 3 years by Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner, outlines the administration's vision for ending the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm joined in the studio by the world's Ariel Osoran. So, Ariel, you listened to President Trump today. What struck you about the president's new peace plan?
Well, Marco, I wouldn't really call it a peace plan. It's more of an Israeli annexation plan.
Yeah, that's a headline I think the Palestinians won't want to hear. Explain what you mean.
Well, there's a lot to dissect here, but for Israelis, this is the most generous plan ever presented. And Prime Minister Netanyahu, who spoke at today's announcement, is delighted.
It's a great plan for Israel. It's a great plan for peace. Frankly, Mr. President, given all that you have already done for Israel, I'm not surprised. You have been the greatest friend that Israel has ever had in the White House.
Ariel, what's in this plan for the Palestinians?
Nothing really in the short term. In this proposed deal, they have 4 years to meet the requirements of the plan in order to get an independent Palestinian state with defined borders. And there's a lot of requirements. They have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state with its capital in Jerusalem. And they'd only get what Trump called Eastern Jerusalem.
Right. Eastern Jerusalem. I mean, is this an actual place? This is kind of beyond East Jerusalem, the capital that the Palestinians want. What is Eastern Jerusalem?
So East Jerusalem would include the old city, holy sites, and everything east of that. Eastern Jerusalem, just east of the old city.
East.
Not including the old city.
And what about the holy sites?
So the holy sites would remain under Jordanian custody like they are today. And Palestinians would also have to disarm all militias, including Hamas, and renounce violence against Israel.
Yeah, that's pretty controversial. What else is in the deal?
Well, and this is key, the plan would allow Israel to impose its sovereignty over the majority of settlements in the West Bank.
So that's why you called it an annexation plan earlier.
Exactly. Another point is the Jordan Valley, which includes the West Bank, could be annexed by Israel under the plan. And Prime Minister Netanyahu said today that he wants to bring forward a legislation to implement that sovereignty over all settlements. That's going to happen as soon as next week.
There's also the very potent issue of the Palestinians' right of return.
Right, Marco. So the plan does not recognize the Palestinian right of return to Israeli territory. That means that the Palestinians displaced since 1948, when Israel was established, would not have the right to return to their former homes. And Marco, there's one more thing that Trump said today that caught my ear.
Today's agreement is a historic opportunity for the Palestinians to finally achieve an independent state of their very own. After 70 years of little progress, this could be the last opportunity they will ever have.
What does he mean by that, the last opportunity?
So this kind of sounds like a threat. I mean, under the proposed deal, Israel would agree to freeze settlement expansion for a period of 4 years. But Trump seems to be telling the Palestinians that if they don't accept his deal, all future hopes for an independent state are gone.
Wow. So my understanding is that what was announced today is the diplomatic part of the deal, but there's also an economic piece of the deal. What's that about?
Yeah, that's right. The first part of the plan, the economic section, was released back in June at a conference in Bahrain. This included significant promises to the Palestinians in the form of $50 billion investment in the Palestinian economy and infrastructure. This money would come from the U.S. and some Arab countries, but the Palestinians won't see any of that money unless they accept the diplomatic part, which was presented today.
I mean, this is, of course, hardly the first time an American president has attempted to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. What makes this attempt different?
Besides being extremely favorable to Israel, the Palestinians aren't really a factor here. We've seen multiple peace processes in the past that didn't work out with the Palestinians at the table. This time, they're not even in the room.
Yeah.
Just imagine a Super Bowl game with the officiating crew and one team on the field, but that's it. No second team.
We'll leave it there. The world's Ariel Osaron, thanks so much for starting us off today.
Thank you, Marco.
In the U.S. Senate, President Trump's legal team has wrapped up early in the impeachment trial of their client. The third and final day of their opening argument ended just before 3 p.m. Eastern. But their hope of a fast trial without new witnesses now appears to be in check. More Republican senators and even some Fox News anchors are suggesting that former National Security Advisor John Bolton needs to be heard. We'll have more on that in a moment. But first, let's review the defense case. The World's Chris Wolf joins me. What did you make of how the defense presented its case, Chris?
Well, Marco, they used day three to coin a catchphrase.
Danger, danger, danger.
Jay Sekulow, one of Trump's lead attorneys, used that phrase repeatedly today, warning of the precedent that this case was setting. But overall, the best word I've seen to characterize the 3 days of the defense's opening argument has been hopscotch. A hopscotch of defenses and deflections. Two paces this way, a pace that way, and then a jump to the side. For example, we've heard it argued that there is no crime in the charges, that no crime was committed, that there's not enough evidence, that you can't allow new evidence, that the evidence doesn't count, that it's all unconstitutional, that maladministration is not impeachable. And of course, what about the Bidens?
So there's a lot you just said there. Are you saying the defense was not very focused?
I think that's a fair thing to say, but it would be wrong to say that the defense was not without merit at certain points. For example, there was a compelling plea from Alan Dershowitz last night for simple justice. Let's hear a bit.
I respectfully urge you not to let your feelings about one man, strong as they may be, to establish a precedent that would undo the work of our founders, injure the constitutional future of our children, and cause irreparable damage to the delicate balance of our system of separation of powers and checks and balances.
Well, Dershowitz mentions there a potential precedent, and he's arguing that this impeachment is needless and driven solely by politics, and that future presidents would suffer from the example. So the defense has not disputed many of the facts of the case in the terms of the aid to Ukraine, but they argue it was right and proper and within the president's, you know, due authority. But I have heard conservative scholars argue that Trump's team have done a good job knocking down the second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress, on the grounds that the House did not allow enough time or pursue all the legal options open to them to get the White House to cooperate. And critics counter that argument by saying the failure to cooperate was so absolute and comprehensive that any, you know, wait for legal courses of action to be followed would have been futile. Trump attorney Patrick Philbin addressed this directly yesterday.
They say that they have no time for the courts. I think what that really means is they have no time for the rule of law in the way that they're pursuing the inquiry.
You spoke about deflections by the defense team, Chris. So what do you mean?
Well, we had a long exposition yesterday on the career of Hunter Biden and his ties to the Ukrainian energy company Burisma. Now, Democrats argue that's just political grandstanding, using primetime to smear the Biden family just ahead of the Iowa caucus.
Have Trump's lawyers mentioned former NSA John Bolton at all, or the allegation in his book manuscript in which the president himself told Bolton that the aid to Ukraine was being held up until they agreed to investigate the Bidens?
Yeah, Alan Dershowitz addressed it last night and was quoted again today by Jay Sekulow.
Nothing in the Bolton revelations, even if true, would rise to the level of abuse of power or an impeachable offense. That is clear from history.
And the Senate will get to vote in the next few days on whether witnesses like Bolton could be called to testify.
The World's Chris Wolf, thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Marco.
Emerging in Washington right now are two parallel narratives, what's being said in the Senate trial and what's getting discussed outside the trial. I'm referring to John Bolton's unpublished book manuscript. It upends the claims that the Senate has no firsthand witnesses who can say Trump linked military aid for Ukraine to political favors. To help us understand how the Bolton revelations are roiling the impeachment proceedings, we reached out to Susan Hennessy. She's a senior fellow at Brookings and the co-author of Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. I asked Hennessy whether Bolton's manuscript will force the Senate to call witnesses to the trial.
Yeah, so the short answer is we don't know. It certainly dramatically increases the likelihood of this. So it appears the Republicans are now essentially trying to test the political waters to see if they can effectively get away with not calling him. It would be a very, very politically difficult case to make for members to justify to the public why exactly they didn't feel the need to hear this testimony prior to actually voting.
If there's one witness like Bolton, does that open the floodgates for more? And does that become kind of a tit for tat then, like Republicans and Democrats calling who they want?
Yeah, so this is clearly one thing that Republicans are concerned about, that if they allow John Bolton's testimony, they then might be in a position to also need to get testimony from people like Rudy Giuliani, Robert O'Brien, other individuals who the House actually did subpoena, and their failure to comply with that subpoena serves as the basis of one of the articles of impeachment for obstruction of Congress. Now, we've heard Republicans suggest that maybe they would be open to a one-for-one trade, having somebody like John Bolton testify in exchange for, say, Hunter Biden. The problem with that sort of argument is that John Bolton is plainly relevant to the proceedings at issue, and Hunter Biden isn't. So whenever Republicans suggest that that's what they want, what they're saying is this trial is really not about a genuine truth-seeking function. They're saying if they can't prevent John Bolton from testifying, they're going to try and make these proceedings as maximally politically consequential for the Democrats as well by essentially perpetuating the smear that got Trump into this mess in the first instance.
Of course, a testimony of one or several witnesses might not even move the needle at all in terms of the outcome of the trial, right?
I think that seems more likely than not. It really does appear that we're in sort of a predetermined outcome. The president is overwhelmingly likely to be acquitted, not convicted, which of course requires 67 votes in the Senate. That said, from the outset, this trial has always been about producing information for the public, educating the public about what happened here and making a clear statement so that even if the Senate declines to discharge their function, the American people can render their own judgment in November 2020 about whether or not the ways in which Donald Trump has used and abused the powers of his office, whether or not that's acceptable to them, because ultimately the November 2020 election will also be a referendum on whether or not they believe the current situation is tolerable or acceptable.
Susan, Senator Lindsey Graham and others are suggesting Bolton's manuscript be made available to the Senate in a classified setting, like they would go into a secret room and just sit there and read it. Is that a non-starter, or is it a scenario that actually might unfold?
It's just not something that really makes much sense at all. So John Bolton's manuscript is reportedly undergoing the process of pre-publication review. That means that John Bolton has said that he's written a manuscript that doesn't contain any classified information. The government is going through sort of a checking process that he's agreed to participate in as a condition of receiving his security clearance. There's not a presumption that information is classified. The presumption is that information is unclassified. And of course, Bolton would have every incentive to be really, really careful at not including classified information in his book. So the idea that Senator Graham would suggest that the Senate use classified facilities in order to review this manuscript suggests that he's not necessarily concerned about there being classified information in the book, because of course there's a separate process underway to protect against those disclosures, but instead that he might be using this classified setting as a way to prevent the information contained in the book from getting out to the American public. And that really is not what classification and the systems designed to protect it is designed for.
Susan Hennessy, senior fellow at Brookings and the co-author of Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. Susan, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Chief Justice John Roberts isn't just busy with the Senate impeachment trial this week. The Supreme Court has decided to allow the Trump administration to temporarily go ahead with new immigration rules. This will make it easier for U.S. officials to deny green cards for immigrants who use public assistance programs. No green card means they don't get legal permanent residency. The World's Monica Campbell has more about how people are absorbing the news and the efforts on the ground to clear up confusion about the rules.
The Supreme Court decided to let the new public charge rules go forward. But first, what's a public charge? someone who may be tapping certain public assistance programs like Medicaid, public housing help, or food stamps. Isabel Martinez was picking lemons at a farm near Southern California when she heard the news. Martinez is 26 and has lived in the U.S. since she was a kid. She has a work permit, not a green card, but she would like one. That would give her permanent residency in the U.S. She wonders how the new rules might change that. So when she got an alert that there'd be an emergency meeting in her neighborhood about the Supreme Court news, she went. What about my daughter? She asked. She's 10 and was recently diagnosed with lupus, but she's also a U.S. citizen. Will my daughter's medical treatment block my chances of getting a green card? Luz Gallegos from the TODEC Legal Center told Martinez the answer is no, a clear no.
She should stay on benefit and this won't go against her.
Gallegos helped run the meeting Martinez went to, and she worries about the confusion over who is affected and not affected by the public charge rule. Will that keep immigrant families and their U.S. citizen kids away from government programs they're eligible for?
This is another way that we see this administration trying to create fear. So it's very important what we're telling community is every case is different. What happens to your vecina, to your neighbor, to your comadre, to your friends is not the same as you. So it's important to get individualized information and consultation on your individual case.
Under the new rules, if someone is found receiving public benefits, like food stamps, for example, they might not get a green card. In reality, that's not a huge number of immigrants in the U.S., but the rules are confusing and might be enough to keep people away from public assistance. Who might be affected most are people applying for green cards from abroad. They may be looked at with a lot more scrutiny. So someone's education, their English fluency, and other factors could be weighed more heavily. That would have a big impact on who gets a green card and who doesn't, says Julia Galat with the Migration Policy Institute in Washington.
We think it could affect, you know, up to two-thirds of green card applicants, or two-thirds of green card applicants at least may have at least one factor that's considered negatively in this new public charge test.
Galat reckons that the people most impacted here will be from the poorest parts of Latin America, Asia, and Africa. Isabel Martinez, the farm worker from California, was relieved when she found out more about the public charge rule and that it would not penalize her or her daughter for the care or benefits they receive. But she says she's still uneasy about her hopes for a green card one day. She says she's unsure what might happen next, if the rules might change again. For now, though, it's an uncertainty she says she must live with. For The World, Monica Campbell.
President Trump's immigration policies aren't just impacting the U.S. border. They're impacting Mexico's as well. Last week, a migrant caravan of around 4,000 people attempted to cross the Mexico-Guatemala border. They were met by Mexican authorities armed with riot gear, tear gas, and batons. The show of force was, in effect, a response to pressure from the Trump administration to keep migrants from reaching the U.S. Anaces Valenzuela is the general director of Sin Fronteras, a migrants advocacy group in Mexico City.
We do have to understand that these people are basically fleeing away from their country, from a violent situation, and we're receiving them with more violence. And in Mexico, to have an undocumented status, it doesn't mean that you are committing a crime. It's only an administrative offense, which should be handled in a different way.
It was Mexican authorities, of course, that used this force, but is this the result of pressure from the Trump administration?
Mexico committed to display the National Guard to help in these migratory control policies. This kind of policy is against the Global Compact of Migration that Mexico has subscribed, and it is also against our national legislation. So we have to work on our own migratory policy and stop reacting to what probably is an electoral agenda for President Trump in the United States.
Where are the people in the migrant caravan now? Because reportedly 800 people were detained after the caravan was broken up.
Basically, they are either in detention centers or they are just hiding, which places the people in a very, very risky situation.
What is the situation with facilities and the infrastructure for people who are detained?
The detention centers are overcrowded. We have documented and seen very precarious conditions that they don't cover the minimal necessities of health or even food or access to, for example, mental health. It is really, really worrying that we find all the time children in these migratory facilities.
Along with the change in policy, have there been enough resources allocated to the facilities that do exist in Mexico to make sure that they can function properly for all these people that are getting detained?
This government has invested in these facilities, but it's not enough because this kind of policy is not sustainable, not even from an economic or from a human rights point of view. We should be allocating more resources in the agency in charge of processing asylum seekers' claims or in documenting persons and not only in these detention centers.
So, Ana, if this policy is the new normal in Mexico, is it sustainable without that investment?
No, it's not. And also this display of the National Guard, when we have so many security problems within the country, we have to really assess if this policy is really effective and sustainable, because we believe that the National Guard should be doing other kind of tasks. And Mexico has always been a country receiving people from Central America, but now we have to change the way we have addressed the situation because people are arriving together in these so-called caravans.
Ana Cés Valenzuela, the director of Sin Fronteras, a migrants advocacy group in Mexico City. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
You're listening to The World. In a World War II transit camp in France, a prisoner takes in the bad news.
So he told me there is a train which will come pick you up and send you to Poland to a working camp. He didn't remember the name, but I think he mentioned Auschwitz.
We conclude our story of resistance fighter Eustace Rosenberg. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. China's leader, Xi Jinping, vowed today to defeat the devil coronavirus that's now killed more than 100 people in China. Xi met with the head of the World Health Organization in Beijing. The epidemic is a devil, he said. We cannot let the devil hide. Here's the thing, though. Beijing has struggled to maintain credibility about its efforts to contain the outbreak, and that's because party officials tend to sugarcoat bad news. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
China's central government recently posted a warning to all local officials, the ones battling the virus outbreak on the front lines. It says, if any of you try to cover up how bad this is, you will be, quote, nailed to the pillar of shame for eternity.
This is a clear message to the local officials that you're going to be in trouble if you don't report truthfully to the central authorities.
That's Adam Ni, a political analyst with China Neichan, a newsletter that looks at Chinese policy. He spoke to me from Australia. And about that warning, he says,
it's quite unusual that it's so explicit and so high profile.
But see, the central government knows that local officials do this, that they like to make it seem like they've got everything under control to protect their careers. In fact, that's exactly what the officials initially did in the city of Wuhan, ground zero for this virus. They downplayed how fast the disease was spreading, and Adam Ni says, they even detained reporters trying to figure out the truth.
We can only speculate that if at the early stages the local government was more forthcoming, potentially we wouldn't be in the place that we are today.
Where we are today is pretty scary. China has created one of the largest quarantine zones ever. 30 to 50 million people are now held in place, with hospitals maxed out and families stockpiling food. At an infectious disease center in Wuhan, doctors wear full-on biohazard suits. They isolate patients in little rooms and are so afraid of contact that they see them face-to-face only when necessary, preferring to talk via video chat. That's a clip from Chinese state media, a doctor talking to another medical professional who got the virus himself at work. Now, this kind of outbreak might cause panic anywhere, but analyst Adam Nee says it's a little worse in China because the public often fears that officials are not being fully honest about bad news.
I think the Chinese public will be quite skeptical about the party's response to the crisis in Wuhan.
And that distrust drives people to seek answers on WeChat, China's main social media site.
There's just so much misinformation and rumors spreading on the Chinese social media at the moment.
Rumors like airplanes are going to bombard Beijing with disinfectant spray. Not true. Overall, holding on to the public's trust will be one of the biggest tests so far for President Xi Jinping. And his new strategy is to present this as a great battle, or as Adam Nee describes it,
conducting warfare, a people's war against this new disease.
In a people's war, China can play to its strengths. An authoritarian state may be slow to admit mistakes, but it can do monumental things really fast, like quarantine a giant chunk of the country, or in Wuhan, build a brand new 1,000-bed hospital in a matter of days. Turn on the TV in China, and you may see videos like this. That is a montage of bulldozers and cranes frantically building that hospital, set to rousing music fit for a patriotic action movie. They say this huge facility will be built from scratch within a week. Sounds unreal, right? But if you think that's BS, state-run media offers an online video feed of the construction site, so the public can be assured this engineering feat is real. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
The uncertainty of what information to rely on in Wuhan is especially difficult for people who are not Chinese. Amir Razak is a student from Pakistan and is studying in Wuhan. And while the rest of the university has emptied out for the Chinese New Year, international students like Amir are stuck on campus.
Most of the campus is empty and I'm still here, so it's like deserted, you know? So it's kind of a little scary, you know?
So what has the university told you? Are classes canceled indefinitely?
Yeah, we get a notification from the authorities that the spring semester has been postponed until further notice. So we don't know when it will start again.
Did your professors give you a bunch of assignments to keep you busy? And if so, for how many weeks?
Yeah, you know, I'm a research scholar, so my professor asked me to read some papers and finish my own paper.
So how else are you passing the time?
How else? You know, just staying inside and binging some series. And most of the times I'm reading the news, virus news. Is it getting serious or not?
Well, we hear that Wuhan, where you are, the city is on lockdown. So how free are you to move around in the city of Wuhan?
No. They are telling us that we should not go outside our campus because all non-essential travels are banned. But definitely I can go out of my dormitory.
Amir, how worried are you about getting sick?
Yeah, definitely. I'm very much worried and my family is also very much worried because, you know, sometimes I also think maybe I'm hiding the virus inside. So, yeah, I'm very much worried.
Where have you been getting, like, your medical information on this coronavirus? And what information are you trusting?
Our embassy is in touch with us.
The Pakistan embassy.
Yeah. And also our school administration, they are sending the information which we need, what we need to do in case of emergency or what could be the possible symptoms, you know.
Amir, what are you doing for food? How are you eating?
There is one canteen open during the lunch and dinner timings here. So we go there and eat. But I would prefer to cook my food myself, you know.
You want to stay away from a lot of people.
Yeah, I cannot trust the people who are cooking. You know, maybe somebody has the virus and I can indirectly get it from my food, right? So I think most of the people, they want to cook their own food.
Now, your parents, they're still in Pakistan. Where do they live?
They live in Punjab, you know, Islamabad, the capital.
Yeah. And what have the conversations been like with them over the past month?
I didn't tell them in the start because I wasn't very much concerned in the start. But later they got it from the news and they called me every day and they asked me to come back. But I will think twice whether should I go back or not. Maybe I can bring the virus to my family, you know, and expose them in the danger.
And what have you heard from your parents about their concerns?
Yeah, their concerns, they do not know that it can transmit, you know, very easily. And it can also transmit during the incubation period. But I know this. So I just try to play down the situation because they are old and they'll be thinking about this all the time. So I intentionally tell them it's all right. It's just normal flu like that. Yeah, but every day they get it on the news. So news is very much, you know, exaggerating and scary, but it is scary.
Amir, try to stay healthy. We're thinking of you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Amir Razak is a doctoral student on lockdown at a university in Wuhan, China. Now, an update to a story we aired earlier this month about how Brexit is messing with British science. Academic grant funding from continental Europe has dropped since Brexit was first announced, and fewer European researchers are coming to the UK on some fellowships. In response to these concerns, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson had part of his answer this week, a new fast-track visa program for scientists.
What we want is to end the situation in which you have uncontrolled immigration coming in for low-skilled jobs, pushing down wages and make sure that we have a route in to the UK for mathematicians, scientists, people who are going to contribute massively to our economy.
These scientists wouldn't need job offers before relocating to Britain. They'll just have to be endorsed by one of Britain's major scientific bodies. And there is no limit to the number of visas that might be offered. The new scientific route into the UK is slated to open on February 20th, just a few weeks after the UK officially leaves Europe. That happens this Friday night when we'll be covering the celebrations from pro-Brexiteers in London. The really big news out of the UK today is all about Huawei, the Chinese technology company. The UK is saying that it will not ban Huawei from being used in its new high-speed 5G wireless network. The Trump administration has lobbied aggressively against Huawei's expansion to the UK and elsewhere. And now the UK seems to be in the middle of the US and China's cold tech war. Lydia Manalidou covers technology for The World. Is this a blow to U.S. anti-Huawei efforts, Lydia?
Yeah, it's a really big blow. As you said, Marco, the U.S. has been on this intense lobbying campaign to get Britain to keep Huawei out of its 5G infrastructure. That campaign has been going on for more than a year now, and we saw it ramp up a lot recently. Just a few days ago, three Republican senators sent a strongly worded letter to the UK's National Security Council asking them again to reject Huawei. They said this was a, quote, genuine plea from one ally to another. But despite those efforts, the British government said today that Huawei could be used in its 5G networks, though with some restrictions.
Why would Britain not block Huawei? Don't they share the same concerns as the US?
You know, Marco, not everyone is happy with this approach. Here's former cabinet minister David Davies.
It was a great mistake to let them in the first place. I mean, you know, to put it in silly terms, in 1937, the Germans made very good submarines, but we didn't buy them. In 1977, the Russians made very good radar, but we didn't buy that either for a very good reason.
The U.S. concern, Marco, has been for years now that the Chinese government could plant backdoors in Huawei equipment and use those backdoors for espionage and spying. Those are allegations that Huawei denies. And by the way, they're allegations that security experts I've talked to have questioned. They say that we don't have that evidence, at least not unclassified evidence, to prove that. And a lot of experts will tell you that a lot of this comes down to the U.S. wanting to dominate the 5G space. As for the U.K., officials there did acknowledge they do believe there are some risks with Huawei technology, but they say they also have to balance that with getting on board with the latest technology and providing that to their citizens.
there will be some limitations to Huawei's presence in the UK, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Right. According to the rules that were released today, technology made by companies like Huawei have to be kept out of parts of the network that carry sensitive data. They'll be excluded from sensitive locations like nuclear sites and military bases. And UK officials say that's a decision they made in collaboration with intelligence officials. Here's the UK's Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, speaking about the decision earlier today.
It reflects the maturity of the UK's market and our world-leading cybersecurity expertise. And it follows a rigorous and evidence-based review. It is the right decision for the UK's specific circumstances.
So, Lydia, the UK is part of Five Eyes, this intelligence sharing group with the US and a few other countries. Officials here in the US had threatened to limit that intelligence sharing with Britain if they go with Huawei, because they argue that would put the US at risk. Is that likely to happen now?
UK officials don't seem to think it's likely to happen, but it is something the Trump administration has threatened to do. And just last week, Representative Jim Banks, he's a Republican from Indiana, introduced legislation that would stop intelligence sharing with countries that use Huawei in their infrastructure. Though, again, UK officials have said they don't think this is going to happen.
It sounds like governments are eager to get their hands on 5G, but what is the hype all about?
To put it in simple terms, 5G is basically like 4G, but much, much faster. So you can imagine your uploads and downloads going much, much faster. And it'll be the backbone that powers all the internet-connected devices that already exist and the many more to come. Like, think about all the elements that are in smart cities. Think about self-driving cars. All of that will be powered by 5G networks.
There was Lydia Manalidou. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Our BBC family lost a legend today, veteran comedian and broadcaster Nicholas Parsons in his 90s. Parsons' story is similar to that of many entertainers. Born in a small town, went to school carving out a practical path, engineering. But at night he worked at a local theater, and that was the end of engineering. Parsons soon began what would be a career in acting, entertaining the public for 7 decades. He appeared on stage in hit plays in London's West End. In the 1960s, Parsons became the straight man to another comedian, Arthur Haynes.
But this sounds absolutely appalling. But, Mr. Haynes, have you no idea what causes these attacks?
Oh, yeah, we know what causes it.
Oh, you do? Well, what is it?
Gin.
Parsons appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show 6 times. But if you know of Parsons, it's probably because of BBC's Just a Minute. He hosted the show from its start in 1967.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Nicholas Parsons.
Just a Minute is a simple game show
in which I ask 4 guests to speak on a subject they give them, and they try and do that without hesitation, repetition, or deviating from the subject.
A 60-second rant with those constraints. Parsons hosted the show for 52 years. During that time, he only missed 2 recordings. Last September was Parsons' final edition of Just a Minute, just before his 96th birthday. His friend and BBC DJ Tony Blackburn paid tribute today on a British morning show.
For his 90th birthday, we went along to his 90th party, and we gave him a Superman dressing gown. And every time I saw him, he said, "I love that dressing gown." But we gave it to him, and I said, "It's because you are a Superman."
Broadcast legend Nicholas Parsons was 96. Let's get back now to the story of Eustace Rosenberg. I introduced you to him yesterday. His new memoir is called The Art of Resistance, about fighting in the French underground during World War II. We left his story in 1942 in Marseille, where Eustace helped Jews and other refugees escape the Nazis. After Eustace was recruited by the underground, he spied on the Germans in Nazi-occupied France for several months, but then got caught. He was picked up one morning in a sweep, put on a bus with other detainees, and taken to a transit camp outside of Lyon.
It was September. The barrack was filled with young people, with old people, with mothers and children. I just couldn't stay there, so I decided to hell with it. There was a curfew. You had to be inside by 9 o'clock in the evening. I said, the hell with it. It's too hot. I went outside, and I lay down in the grass. Suddenly, I woke up with somebody kicking me in the side and a flashlight shining me in my face. And a French voice says, "Qu'est-ce que vous faites là? What are you doing here?"
It was a French policeman who began to soften as this blonde-haired, blue-eyed young man began to speak perfect French.
Again, I said, "Well, what chance do I have?" I said, "Well, tell me, could you tell me what I'm doing here?" So he told me the whole story. He says, oh, well, you're just going to be here for a while until there is a train which will come pick you up and send you to Poland to a working camp. He says, yes, I think he didn't remember the name, but I think he mentioned Auschwitz.
Eustace began brainstorming a way to escape. The next day, as he paced around the camp, he noticed the long line of people waiting to get into the infirmary. Then he runs into, as if on cue, the sister of a friend who happened to be a medical student at the University of Lyon.
It gave me an idea. I said, listen, since you're a medical student, well, we talked about it, and she said, could you give me a disease which would make me get into the infirmary without having to stand in line? She says, well, we talked about it. She said...
She came up with peritonitis, a potentially fatal swelling of the abdomen. You'll have to act like you've got extreme pain, she told him. You'll have to make yourself vomit. You'll need to fake a fever, she said.
In Danzig, I had been in the theater and in Paris, I was also an extra in one of the big thunders. So I know. I said,
you knew how to act.
Yeah, I knew how to act. I still do to this day. So... in other words...
Long story short, his friend told the infirmary doctors that there was a boy about to die in the yard. Eustace pulled off his peritonitis act convincingly, doubled over in pain, even heating up the thermometer on the sly to fake a 105 fever.
And at 9 o'clock that evening, I found myself on the way to the hospital in Lyon. I arrived there, they looked at it, and they operated me that very same night.
Eustace woke up in pain. He got the morphine he needed, thanks to one person.
A nurse who was very sympathetic to me. You know, I was a cute boy, and I guess I suppose that was helped. And this nurse, many French people were, although they couldn't openly admit it, were against the Nazis. And that is the art of resistance. That's what I mean by the art of resistance. She gave me a shot, and when I woke up, she was sitting next to my bedside.
And helped him escape from the guarded ward of the hospital. For the next 2 years, Eustace fought again with the French underground. He'd started relaying intel. Now he was building bombs and learning how to use weapons. In June of 1944, Allied troops began their invasion of France. Eustace Rosenberg and his mates fought alongside American troops for the rest of the war.
The forces of the Southern Landing were now joined with those of General Eisenhower and came under his command. The plan was working out.
When the war ended, Eustace worked with the UN, helping to resettle millions of displaced people across Europe. In 1946, he emigrated to America. We've heard the word resistance a lot over the past few years. And Eustace Rosenberg's book, The Art of Resistance, made me want to ask him this.
How did you know when the right moment was to react, to say no, to resist?
Well, I think the right moment to say no was once I saw many of the refugees in Marseille and how many of them, how unfair it was that they only got the famous people out.
Right, these were the intellectuals of Europe.
Right. Well, they were famous, yes, but don't the other people, the ordinary people, also deserve support? That was the moment in my life where I decided that, yes, and I have to do that regardless.
In 2017, Eustace Rosenberg was honored by France with the prestigious title of Commander of the French Legion of Honor. It was a bittersweet affair. In the French Resistance, he had worked bravely on behalf of many people. But his life also depended on many others taking their own risks, the artists of resistance, as he would call them. 3 years ago at the French consulate in New York, he was there, his wife was there, a few friends, but...
My contemporaries were all dead. There was nobody more around anymore. All the people that I mentioned that I was in the French underground with, nobody there. Not a single one.
Eustace Rosenberg's book, The Art of Resistance, My 4 Years in the French Underground, is out today. Let's circle back to the impeachment trial of President Trump. The president's lawyers argued once again today that the Democrats' case is flimsy and partisan. One of the president's attorneys, Jay Sekulow, said legal scholars have offered a common theme with a dire warning.
Danger. 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 To lower the bar of impeachment based on these articles of impeachment would impact the functioning of our constitutional republic and the framework of that constitution for generations.
Sekulow argued that the Democrats are trying to impeach the president because they don't like his Ukraine policy, not because he violated the Constitution.
There is no violation of law. There's no violation of the Constitution. There is a disagreement on policy decisions. Most of those that spoke at your hearings did not like the president's policy.
The president's defense team wrapped up earlier than expected today. Attorney Jay Cipollone delivered the closing remarks.
What they are asking you to do is to throw out a successful president on the eve of an election with no basis and in violation of the Constitution. It would dangerously change our country and weaken forever all of our democratic institutions.
Senators will submit written questions to both sides tomorrow and Thursday. We'll be back on the impeachment trial tomorrow and on all the other news from across the world. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you then.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.